Welcome to another episode of Spanish History 101. This is episode 21, the 13th century, and the plot no longer just thickens, it gets downright mucky, murky, turbid, a total mess at times. So to help you make some sense of this, let's put you in the right context. The Spanish kingdoms are slowly expanding, but progress is hindered by the constant fighting amongst themselves, as well as a setback or two by the latest wave or waves of Muslims, in particular the Almohads. If you recall, the Almohads constitute the last major incursion by the Moors. They took over after their predecessors, so to speak, the Almoravids, had lost their grip on Al-Andalus, which was Muslim Spain. The Almohads consolidated their power in that area during the 1160s, and despite their fame as being sort of ferocious warriors, they also had some important contributions to make architecturally and culturally. In fact, it was during this period that they initiated the construction of one of Spain's most iconic and beautiful buildings, the famous Giralda bell tower of the Cathedral of Seville. There are buildings all over the world, both in the Old World and the New World, that are basically either inspired by this tower or almost replicas of it. But that was basically neither here nor there for the Christian forces who were trying to get rid of them, especially Alfonso VIII, who was king of Castile at the time. He took them on at the Battle of Alarcos in 1195 and was pretty much whipped. Alfonso did not count on the support of some of the other kingdoms, in part because he sort of rushed into the battlefield before he was ready and paid a price for it. Anyway, he would not give up so easily. Less than 20 years later, in 1212, he would take on the Almohads again at the famous Battle of Navas de Tolosa, and the outcome would be truly different. It went down in history as one of the most decisive battles and decisive victories of the Reconquista period. What made things different this time? Well, the Christian forces managed to band together for once and launch a united front against the Almohad warriors. It was a true show of unity. The big difference this time was that Pope Innocent III had declared the campaign a crusade and called on forces from around Europe to join in. So not only did you have the Castilians, the Aragonese, and the Navarrans fighting together, even the Leonese, who had to do it sort of on a voluntary basis, but still, it was an amazing show of unity. And on top of that, you had German, French, Italian, and Portuguese crusaders joining in. The Allies, so to speak, sort of slowly banded together in Toledo, in the center of the country, and they sort of lumbered down to confront the immense and fearsome enemy side at the foothills of the Sierra Morena, more specifically around a pass, a mountain pass known as Despeñaperros, which roughly translates as the cliff or the heights where the dogs are flung to their death. It sounds better in Spanish. In any event, the Allied forces reached the northern side of that mountain, the higher part of what would be like La Mancha, and they needed to find their way down to meet the Moors on the plains of Jaén, which would have been now northern Andalusia. Most of the known routes were blocked by the Almohads, and it would have been suicide for the Christian forces to try to enter there. But finally, they came upon a local shepherd who guided them down a little-known path through which they were able to surprise the army, which was being led by the Almohad leader Al-Nasir. They met on the battlefield on July 16th, that is smack in the middle of summer, smack in the middle of Spain, in the middle of Andalusia or inland, where the heat is just horrific. There was nothing about the climate that made it favorable for combat. It was a grueling day of warfare, old-fashioned sort of scrum fighting, with both sides slugging it out in hand-to-hand combat. Little room for archers and mounted knights to make a difference. the Muslims were defeated decisively. And by decisively, I mean that essentially, after this loss, the threat of Islam or the Muslims in Al-Andalus was gone forever. That doesn't mean they were gone, and we still have many more years left before the end of the Reconquista, but never again would they pose a serious threat to the Christian kingdoms. And it sort of opened the floodgates, especially for the Kingdom of Castile. But that would take a little while. In other words, it wasn't next day. In fact, Castile would not really get started again for another 20 years. In other words, Alfonso VIII didn't follow up. He actually died 2 years later in 1214. The Almohads, on their end, were going through crisis after crisis, and by 1228, a huge power vacuum spurred the Christian forces to embark on another campaign to press forward with their territorial ambitions. It was highly successful. As I was telling you before, Alfonso VIII was no longer around. He was succeeded by his son, Henry I, or Enrique I, but only for about 3 years. Enrique was 10 years old, I believe, when he was named king. 3 years later, he was killed in a freak accident when a stone, or a tile, I believe it was, fell on his head from a tower while he was playing with friends in the town of Palencia. It sounds a little bit suspicious when you think about it, but was apparently a bona fide mishap. It seems that the wound was so bad that the doctors tried to perform a sort of brain surgery on the kid, and it didn't go well. When they found the child's skull, they were able to examine firsthand the hole in the cranium where they actually tried to perform the surgery. And once you see it, you realize why the poor kid died a few days later. Anyway, his aunt, Berengaria, took over briefly in 1217, but she renounced the throne in favor of her son, Fernando III. He was the grandson of Alfonso VIII. And Fernando's reign would go down as one of the most important during this period. Fernando was an all-around kick-ass ruler of his day, a real winner. Successful as a monarch, he unified the crowns of León and Castile, basically permanently. Successful as a warrior, he conquered large swaths of land of Al-Andalus. Successful as a husband and father, he had 15 children from two marriages, and his first son would also go on to be one of the greatest kings in Spanish history. I'll tell you about him in a second. Successful spiritually, he was canonized in 1671 and is also known as Fernando the Saint. That nickname is no exaggeration. He actually is one. If you ever see names of towns or cities called San Fernando in California, they have the San Fernando Valley. You now know what that comes from. It comes from the name of this king. Fernando unified the kingdoms, as I said. He tried to streamline administrative procedures. He tried to measure his taxes carefully as not to overburden the more modest subjects in his kingdom. He ordered the construction of the magnificent Cathedral of Burgos, probably the most famous in Spain, and was instrumental in the building of two other cathedrals, León and Toledo, also magnificent churches. All three basically constitute the trinity of great Spanish Gothic cathedrals. He also contributed to the University of Salamanca. Basically, there was nothing he couldn't do or didn't do except live on forever. He died in 1252. That very year, his son, Alfonso X, took over, and he had a tough act to follow. His father apparently left him in his will all of Visigothic Spain, which no less was an exaggeration and not an easily definable legacy. In any event, he departed with a challenge for his son. He told Alfonso that if he made Castile bigger, then he would be a better king than him. If he left it the same size, he would be no greater than him. And if he left it in a more reduced size, then he would have been a worse monarch than his father. Clearly, territory was the sole factor in determining one's greatness at the time. Alfonso achieved the first of the three, expanding Castile's border further south to Cadiz and beyond. And the Moors were practically cornered from there until their final departure in 1492. Alfonso also signed two very important treaties, one with Portugal under the Treaty of Badajoz, which established the borders between Spain and Portugal, and they pretty much have remained the same ever since, except for the years when Spain had absorbed the Kingdom of Portugal. We'll get to that in due time. And then he signed another treaty with Aragon with the same aims in mind. We'll talk about Aragon in a second. Now, Alfonso devoted much of his reign to intellectual and academic pursuits. He also pursued women relentlessly. He had numerous lovers, one of which was his own aunt, and numerous children outside of wedlock, one of which was with the same aunt, in addition to the 11 children he had through his marriage to a woman named Violante, who was the daughter of the legendary Aragonese king James I, or Jaime I. But getting back to his scholarly interests, Alfonso was a writer, a promoter of the arts and higher education. He declared Salamanca to be a university, making it the oldest in Europe with that status. That doesn't mean it was the oldest university in Europe, and it wasn't the first one in Spain. The first one in Spain was Palencia, but that has since disappeared. But anyway, some consider this to be the oldest university to be called a university. He also promoted the translation and diffusion of many of the works from antiquity, which had survived in Muslim-controlled Spain, as well as valuable scientific and medical volumes from the Moors themselves. But he is most closely associated with the famous literary work Cantigas de Santa Maria, which are basically 400 poems mainly written to be sung. The problem is no one seems to know much about the melodies for these songs, so it's hard to sing them. In any event, Alfonso actually wrote approximately 30 of the lyrics. They were written in a language which is most closely associated with modern-day Galician and not Spanish. And that's because Alfonso was also fluent in that language. Alfonso also helped formalize the creation of the Mesta. And we're going to have to talk about that one day because it's really interesting. And that's sort of the Livestock Owners Guild. It sort of ended up being focused mainly on sheep and their wool production, which for many years was the soul and heart of Castile's industry during these centuries previous to the discovery of America. As I was saying, it's a really cool subject, and I will definitely be devoting a podcast to it one day. The final years of Alfonso's reign were marked by internal tensions caused by a feud over who would be the next king, since his son and heir apparent, Fernando de la Cerda, had died prematurely, and his younger brother, Sancho, claimed to be next in line, as was customary in Castilian law. Alfonso at first agreed, but later changed his mind and felt the honor should be bestowed upon Fernando's son, in accordance to Roman law. So we had this conflict of interest, this conflict of sort of this legal battle. And it was this change of heart that nearly cost him his kingdom. A civil war broke out, and it was a big mess. I won't go into all the details now, but Alfonso died before it could be resolved fully. Sancho took over and reigned for the next 10 years. He was called Sancho IV, known as Sancho the Brave. He died in 1296. To make matters more confusing, we might as well throw in a few more Sanchos. This time, the Sanchos of Navarra or Navarre, the sort of Basque French kingdom in the north of Spain along the Pyrenees on the border of France. There was a Sancho called Sancho VI. This is a different one, okay? Another totally different Sancho, who has gone down in history as being the first official king of Navarre, okay? As opposed to the king of Pamplona, as they were called up until then. We are talking about the previous century. We're talking 1150. His son, Sancho VII, reigned from 1194 to 1234. His late arrival at the Battle of Alarcos, remember I was telling you about that defeat that Alfonso VIII suffered, made relations between Alfonso VIII and Navarra very tense. It was probably for the best, though, for Navarra, since the battle was so humiliating for the Christian forces. If you weren't there, you were probably better off. He made up for it, though, at the Battle of Navas de Tolosa, where he proved to be one of the bravest knights there. Overall, his reign is considered to be a successful one, but he failed to have an heir. So upon his death, the Ximenes dynasty, which was the one that had been ruling there since, I believe, the 9th century, something like that, came to an end. And it was replaced by a French dynasty known as the House of Blois, Blois, excuse my pronunciation or mispronunciation there, originally from the Champagne region, all the way up in the north of France. The first king was Theobald I. He reigned until 1253, and then Theobald II until 1270. And after a brief reign by Henry I of France, the throne was taken up in 1270 until 1305 by a woman named Juana I, or Joan I of Navarre. She would marry King Philip IV of France, and together they would give birth to, or she would, more accurately, and raise no fewer than three future kings of France. In any event, it's safe to say that for a large part of the 13th century, the Kingdom of Navarra or Navarre was preoccupied with business from their neighbors to the north, that is France. Now let's cut over to the Crown of Aragon, which was going through its own period of transformation. Remember that Aragon was sort of a super kingdom and was actually basically two powers in one. We had Aragon, the kingdom, and Catalonia, known as the Catalan counties. Now let's backtrack a little bit and refresh our memories. The northeast of Spain, all along the Pyrenees, used to be a part of the kingdom of the Franks and was known as the Spanish March. This was sort of a buffer zone that helped protect the Franks from the menace of the Muslims to the south. It was comprised of a group of counties and kingdoms, small kingdoms, that the Kingdom of Pamplona that I was telling you about before, the County of Aragon, and a bunch of counties called the Catalan counties, led by one called Barcelona. Eventually, they broke away from the Franks and continued there independently. Then the County of Barcelona slowly became sort of the strongest of the group. And the Count of Barcelona became a kind of de facto leader of a region which would be called Catalonia. Aragon, as I said, was also a county at first. Most of these were. For example, Castile used to be a county before it turned into a kingdom. And was this Aragon was actually a part of the Kingdom of Pamplona. Then it separated through inheritance and eventually became its own kingdom under Ramiro I in 1035. And after that, it expanded greatly under Alfonso I, the warrior, who took the Muslim stronghold of Zaragoza, that would eventually become the capital of Aragon. And for many years there, a certain degree of rivalry began to grow between Castile and Aragon. When Alfonso the Warrior, Batallador, as they call it in Spanish, died, his brother, a monk, took over and had a daughter named Petronila, who eventually married the Count of Barcelona, named Ramon Berenguer IV. Their son, Alfonso II, and now this is a whole other group of Alfonsos, different from the ones in Castile, so just to make things more confusing. Anyway, he would inherit both thrones. And once that happened, the Crown of Aragon was created. This was 1164. So that's why it's so important to differentiate the Kingdom of Aragon from the Crown of Aragon. The former is the original kingdom of Aragon, and the latter was sort of a confederation of kingdoms and counties under the name Aragon. Each region and territory kept its own government, laws, and in a sense, individuality. Aragon kept the name, but in many ways it was boosted by the mercantile prowess of the Catalans and their prosperous trading industry. By the 13th century, expansion moved further south. The key figure here was King James I, we mentioned him before, of Aragon. He ruled for much of the 13th century. His reign lasted from 1213 to 1276, and that gave him plenty of time to expand the interest of the crown. He took Valencia for good, not just the city, but the whole region along the eastern seaboard of Spain, and the Balearic Islands were controlled too. As I was telling you before, James's daughter, Violante, married Alfonso X of Castile. His son, Pedro III, was next to rule and ruled until 1285. He was followed by Alfonso III until 1291. And despite the brevity of his reign, the tenure was active. He conquered Mallorca, Ibiza, and Menorca. And he also improved relations with the nobility of Aragon. Remember, these kings were kings, but they weren't absolute rulers yet. They had to work with the nobility. At this point, Aragon's interests are beginning to expand eastward into the Mediterranean, to islands like Sardinia, Corsica, and Sicily. Then James II would take over and rule well into the next century, so we'll hold off on him for the moment. So to sum up, Castile has pretty much taken over as the supreme power in the center of the country, especially after the victory of Navas de Tolosa in 1212. In addition, the kingdom will begin to flourish culturally as universities are founded and knowledge is spread. And to the east, Aragon has consolidated its position in that part of Spain and will eventually unite with the other realms, especially the Catalan counties, to form the crown of Aragon. Aragon will begin to set its sights on the Mediterranean for commercial rights. Navarre is feeling a bit Frenchy at the moment, but still a solid kingdom in the northern part of Spain. And finally, Al-Andalus, Muslim Spain, has been pretty much relegated to a fairly small, limited territory surrounding Granada. This will become the Kingdom of Granada, founded in 1238, and we'll tell you a lot more about it later on, but the sense is that the Christian kingdoms probably could have finished the job off at this point, but instead they reaped the benefits of annual tributes being paid to them by the weakened Islamic state. And we'll stop there. Around 1300, that was a lot, I'll admit. I hope it made some sense to you. If not, I'll clarify anything in the future. If you thought at all that this would be getting any easier to follow, think again. I'm doing my best to give you the very general gist without leaving out too much, because it's important to bear all of this in mind when learning about this country, even its impact on the country today. It's a Herculean task, but I hope some of this is helping you out. We hope you've enjoyed this podcast by Brian Spain Domain. Please feel free to leave us with any comments because we love the feedback. You can subscribe to our podcast on Spotify, Amazon, Apple, and Castos. Or if you wish to support Brian Spain Domain, we'd greatly appreciate it. We work very hard to provide you with the best information about Spain, Spanish history, Spanish culture. You can do so by clicking on our PayPal donate button, or if you want to access absolutely all of our podcasts and support us on a regular basis, you can check us out on Patreon at the link provided below. Stay well, stay safe, and hasta pronto.